Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
We are exploring science fiction tonight, something of its history, much about its main themes and sub-themes, and some of its very significant authors. And our two guides to that wonderful literary realm are William Shun and Gary Wolfe. And Gary, let's talk now about this work that you've put together, American Science Fiction, Nine Classic Novels of the 1950s. But first, say something about the Library of America, in which it is contained.
Well, the Library of America is, first of all, they make gorgeous books, and I can't take credit for that. And they began with the idea of preserving the best of American literature in fine editions, fine library editions that you could, and concise editions. So this began with what you would expect, with Emerson, Thoreau, Melville, working its way up to...
All of it originally suggested by, of all people, Edmund Wilson.
Edmund Wilson would frankly be turning over in his grave if he saw some of the things...
You think?
I think so. I mean, he was... He had written famously derisive essays about mystery fiction, about fantasy fiction, about...
Who cares who murdered Roger Ackroyd, wasn't
who
that?
Who cares who murdered Roger Ackroyd?
What was... What was essay?
It was his attack on Agatha Christie.
Yeah.
He had written a very funny and very vicious attack on the work of H.P. Lovecraft, who now has a volume in the Library of America.
Uh-huh.
And in the last several years, and I think it's something to be celebrated, the Library of America has broadened its sense of American culture. There are volumes on noir fiction from the 30s and the 40s, things like The Postman Always Rings Twice or The Talented Mr. Ripley. There's a volume of film criticism from Pauline Kael. There's sports writing is now in the Library of America. And a couple of years ago, I think what was in some ways a precursor of this, my good friend Peter Straub, who's a novelist from New York, had edited a two-volume American Fantastic Tales, which were fantasy and horror stories from the beginning of American literature down to the present. And after that, I was approached by the Library of America to do something similar with science fiction, but with novels. And my argument at that point was that the American science fiction novel, as a novel, not as a group of short stories, was the invention of the 1950s because a science fiction writer could not get a novel published prior to the 1950s except as a serial in a magazine.
So what was the science fiction of the 50s like? How did it differ from what's being turned out today?
One of the things that surprised me when I was looking at these titles is a lot of it isn't that different. Sometimes it's more sophisticated. We're basing it on different assumptions. But the thing that becomes really apparent when you look at these novels is how much they tell us about the 1950s. They are a kind of a beautiful expression of a set of anxieties in what was really a science fictional decade. For example, the 1950s were science fictional in the sense that the wildest dreams, the most optimistic dreams of science fiction, technological utopia, building superhighways, going to the moon and so forth, and the worst nightmares, being wiped out in a nuclear war, both of those were at the surface of everybody's lives in the 50s. We were building gleaming skyscrapers, the Lever Brothers building in New York. Eisenhower signed the Interstate Highway Act in which we built these superhighways and overpasses that you could see in 30s pulp science fiction magazines. And yet everybody was concerned that we were just going to all be wiped out and living in a post-apocalyptic mm-hmm. environment.
Where is that reflected in one or more of these novels?
Well, it's interesting. One of the novels, and unfortunately the only novel in the group by a woman is by Lee Brackett, who herself was a fascinating writer. She had written movies for Howard Hawks. She had worked on the screenplays with William Faulkner. But she started out as a pulp writer. She wrote a novel called The Long Tomorrow in which after some time period after a nuclear war, civilization has reverted to the point where a group calling themselves the New Mennonites are the best able to survive. In effect, it's arguing something that you even see reflected today in movies and TV shows, that the people who are least technological are the ones best able to deal with a post-technological civilization.
I'm remembering a novel. I don't remember the author. You will both know, of course, which is doing the same. And with her, and well, I'll just give you the title, and all the rest then becomes clear. A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yes, that was certainly one of the novels that I would have included. Frankly, had it not been too long, we wanted to get as many novels.
Whose novel is that?
Walter M. Miller, Jr. And it's in three parts, and it deals with...
The desolate post-apocalyptic world.
Yes, in which a small group of monks are preserving what's left of civilization. The title is ironic. The title is satirical because Leibowitz, it turns out, was a Jewish merchant, I think. And the sacred text is a laundry list or a to-do list or something like this, which becomes one of the sacred texts because they can't understand what these these terms from pre-apocalyptic civilization meant.
But a canticle is Catholic in reference.
Yeah, well, yes, it's a group of Catholic monks who are preserving what's left of the world. But then as the novel progresses, the world reinvents technology. It goes through a renaissance and it goes through a period where it looks like it's going to do the same thing all over again, which is nuclear holocaust.
Another novel a film along those lines, was it based upon a novel or not? Well, it was based upon a title from H.G. Wells, though I think they didn't really follow a particular script of H.G. Wells. I am thinking of Things to Come.
Things to Come was an H.G. Wells script.
Did he write the actual movie script?
I'm not sure he wrote the screenplay. He worked with William Cameron Menzies. It was a book that actually he wrote at least the original draft.
Because it's the becoming of the war, and the war is it's anticipating World War II before World War II happened.
This is a 1936 film, I believe, and he basically imagines World War II very accurately, except he imagines it continuing for decades.
It's an air war, and it destroys civilization. Mm-hmm. We have people reduced to barbarism. Ralph Richardson is a wonderful kind of tribal leader, thumping with charismatic excess, but running a debased society. But then come, and this is almost fascistic, then come the men of the air.
The airmen.
The airmen who come out of nowhere. And Raymond Massey has recurring roles in this thing. And they have come to reform and reshape the world.
And they do reshape the world. And it ends with these wonderful utopian, these whitewashed cities underground where they're, at the end of the movie, I think, planning on making the first trip to the moon.
Yes.
So there's a notion behind that, which was a notion that Wells seriously believed in, that rational men, and he generally meant men, following scientific principles could create a utopia.
Well, Wells himself was a very mixed mind. His very last published work, as I remember it, was a set of essays or one long essay titled Mind at the End of Its Tether.
Yes.
Where he had decided mankind was doomed after all, despite all of his optimistic utopian expectations.
Well, keep in mind that here's somebody who had predicted World War II in 5 years before it happened. And when he was writing that essay, World War II was, I believe, still underway.
Yeah.
So he really thought that his worst nightmare had come true.
What are some of the other novels? Something about the other novels in here. Well, nine, after all.
Okay, there are nine. One of the most the first novel I chose for this is one which has possibly had the most continuing influence. Maybe Bill could ask if it could answer this. This is Stars My Destination by Alfred Bester.
It was definitely influential on me when I read this novel at a formative age, and it was Bester's use of language that was so striking to me when I first read this novel. There's an amoral hero, first of all. There's an idea of jaunting or being able to teleport to any place that you can picture. But Bester, in trying to recreate the feeling of synesthesia, where the senses blend together and are confused, used all sorts of what I thought of as jazzy tricks in the writing, trying to recreate this melding of senses by including stylized drawings of words in the text and so forth. I just found it one of the most wildly inventive novels from that period that I had read when I was a teenager.
What happens in it?
Essentially, it's very close to the Count of Monte Cristo. It's a revenge tale. It is about a very uneducated and unpleasant spaceman who is left to die when he's in the wreckage of a spaceship, and another spaceship simply passes him by, and he spends the rest of his life gaining vengeance on this. It's interesting that in addition to this book, we have the Library of America developed a website, the first time they've done so for an individual publication. And I asked contemporary writers to do essays, and the writer who wrote about The Stars My Destination was William Gibson, who is credited as one of the originators of the cyberpunk movement of the 1980s. And it's clear when you look at Gibson's style, that the way language, as Bill says, the way language was used by these writers, that Bester, who was really an advertising agency guy, who wrote only a few novels, had this influence that still is very much alive today. And I think the novel still reads like a very contemporary novel. Did you want to have us read the opening?
I think it would be very good to share some. Yeah.
Sure.
Because the opening paragraph, I think, will give you the flavor.
Yeah, just the first paragraph?
Yeah, let's try that.
This was a golden age, a time of high adventure, rich living, and hard dying. But nobody thought so. This was a future of fortune and theft, pillage and rapine, culture and vice. But nobody admitted it. This was an age of extremes, a fascinating century of freaks. But nobody loved it.
In other words, it has an opening that sounds a lot like Dickens' The Tale of Two Cities.
Absolutely.
Exactly. The best of times, the worst of
exactly.
times. Yeah. We're about to pause for an update, rather just for a round of commercials. But it is also time to invite telephone calls. If you're a science fiction fan and enthusiast and you want to talk about some great book or a set of books that you want all the world to appreciate, give us a call. If you're naive about science fiction but somehow beginning to feel a special interest and you've got a question to raise about it, if there are themes concerning man's fate, man's future, concerning technology, concerning ultimate cosmology and how that might affect the expansion of the human race into the far, far, far distance, if you're interested in time travel and the paradoxes of time travel, if you're interested in anything that might be relevant to science fiction, give us a call, and now's the time to do so. 312-591-7200, of course. 312-591-7200. And if you are listening to us tomorrow, aha, there's a science fiction idea itself.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I'm talking to our friends, particularly listening on the internet on the Pacific, over on the Pacific Rim, who are in midday tomorrow, or wherever you are in the world or in the distant portions of the continent. If you want to join in the conversation, you can do it, of course, also by email. And the email address, as ever, is extension720@wgnradio.com. Extension 720 is one word, at wgnradio.com for calls. 312-591-7200. There's some space available on the board. Get your calls in quickly, and we hope to get to you directly after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And back to Gary Wolfe and William Shun, and a man who I think had more fun being the commander of a space vessel than anybody possibly could have had. William Shatner, mm-hmm. who was never equaled, even though I loved what Patrick Stewart did mm-hmm. as Jean-Luc Godard. But Shatner wandering around space and running into all sorts of interesting people, particularly pneumatic women.
Yes.
And here's a scene
in
from Star Trek.
Right,
right.
What's that?
Sorry, women in various colors of the rainbow.
All of that. And here's Star Trek TV, 1968. It explains itself.
What do you read, Mrs. Bond? Configuration unidentified. Ion propulsion, high velocity, though of a unique technology.
Any contact, Lieutenant?
Failing on all frequencies, sir. All languages have been attempted. No response. Now using standard interstellar symbols.
Keep trying.
Aye, sir.
Magnification 10. Aye, sir.
Nelson's in closing.
Rose got him.
That makes me, but isn't she a beauty?
Interesting design.
I've never seen anything like her. And ion propulsion at that. Ah, they could teach us a thing or two.
Life forms, Mrs. Spock?
One. Humanoid or similar, low level of activity. Life support systems functioning. Interior atmosphere, conventional nitrogen oxygen. Instruments indicate a transferal beam emanating from the area of the humanoid life form.
Directed at what?
Directed at the bridge of the Enterprise, Captain. Security guard?
Security guard to the bridge.
Captain.
name's Kirk. This is the Starship Enterprise.
The music tells us it's a beautiful woman. Or a beautiful space creature.
It's something beautiful. The thing that struck me about this is we couldn't see it. But you almost, in listening to that, could see the blinking lights that go with the beeping noises. there are a couple of, again, on this website, we have a couple of old TV shows from 1953. And as much as they could do it, they had the beeping noises and the blinking lights. And that's what a lot of people think science fiction film is, I'm afraid.
I believe that teleportation must be possible. Beam me up, Scotty, is a request or an order that ultimately will be given and will have consequence.
I'm enough of a science fiction skeptic to want to know how that's going to work.
Well, I'll explain it to you.
Okay, all right.
During the next commercial break.
Okay, right.
It's a little complicated.
That idea, though, led to a fantastic novel by one of the authors in this collection, Rogue Moon by Algis Budrys.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Deals with that very question of teleportation and is the copy that ends up at the other end the same as the person that went in or not? An interesting philosophical question.
All sorts of people tell us, gee, the new physics. People who aren't physicists, but they read popular accounts, tell you, well, the new physics is very different, and somehow it coincides with all of the things we've vaguely known in our spiritual quests, and it opens up other dimensions of reality. And so, of course, teleportation will be possible, just as ultimate mystical illumination is available for a quarter.
One of the most famous epigraphs for a science fiction novel was in Childhood's End by Arthur C. Clarke, which was one of the great transformative novels, Humanity Transforms Itself. The epigraph read, the ideas in this novel are not those of the author. In other words, he was saying he didn't believe in this transcendence business at the end because he couldn't figure out how to get there scientifically. But it made a good story, and we're not going to turn down a good story.
By the way, I've often done programs on astrophysics with good guys from mostly University of Chicago, astrophysics and cosmology. And you know that the new look is string theory and so on, leading to multiverse speculations. Mm-hmm. And increasingly, almost all of these guys say, yeah, the multiverse makes a hell of a lot of sense. There are other universes. There may be an infinity of universes. They may not all be laid out the way our universe is. They may have different physics, different laws, but it goes on in all directions forever, even though we can't contact from one universe to another. As that becomes sort of the established model, the model may change in time, of course. We know that that's one of the ways science works. Mm-hmm. Old paradigms, sooner or later, are knocked over. But forgetting the Kuhnian possibility that paradigm will ultimately disappear, has that affected the multiverse kind of speculation? Has it affected science fiction, contemporary science fiction?
It's affected science fiction from the beginning. There have always been parallel universe novels, maybe even before a lot of this theory was codified. But it's definitely still with us. I read a novel by Paul Melko just a couple of years ago called The Walls of the Universe, which was all about jumping between different dimensions. It's a fun book. It's a lot of those sorts of ideas that derive from quantum physics have ended up in science fiction these days. Thinking of another novel, which is actually more like an old-fashioned fix-up novel where a writer takes a group of stories and just jams them together and calls them a novel. Accelerando by Charles Strauss really explored the idea of quantum computing essentially spreading out throughout the entire solar system and transforming all the matter essentially into a giant computer that people were then sort of subsumed into.
I think there's a Northern Irish-British writer named Ian MacDonald who started a series of young adult novels about alternate universes, and his main character, this teenage boy, is named Hugh Everett after the author of the original paper, I think back in 1955 or so, called The Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. And I talking to older writers who remember that, they were just celebrating because they'd been just making up these alternate universes, and now here's a theory of physics that says we can do it.
Well, it may well be that science fiction inspired the thought of some of those physicists.
It's very possible. There's an interesting project that's been going on with a popular writer named Neal Stephenson, in which he's trying to – he argues that the science fiction of the 40s and 50s, some of the science fiction in books like the ones in this series, actually had a huge influence on people who later became scientists, engineers, and astronauts and so forth. And he was complaining that science fiction today may not be doing that as much.
We're about to pause, update on the news, and then to the phones and to the email, 312-591-7200. If you want to get in there, we've still got some room available on the board. Move quickly and you may well get a space. 312-591-7200 for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Now to the newsroom and Bob Kessler.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
With a quick reintroduction of our guests, and then we will go directly to the phones at 312-591-7200. Those guests are William Shun, science fiction writer and computer expert as well, Gary Wolf, professor of humanities at Roosevelt University, and the editor of American Science Fiction, 9 Classic Novels from the 1950s. It's really quite a wonderful collection, handsomely produced as well in a boxed edition for the two volumes. And gentlemen, with that, we will go to the phones directly, 591-7200. And the first guest on the phones is Edna. Good evening. You're on the air.
This is Edna Budrus, and my husband is in that book, Algis Budrus.
How wonderful.
Yeah, I was very excited when I heard your topic tonight, and I had to call and say thank you to Gary for putting him in there.
Thank you for calling, Edna. I wanted to mention, and Bill had already mentioned Rogue Moon, which is an important novel in its own way, but the novel which is in here is really a Cold War-era novel. And we wanted something to represent the Cold War. We wanted something to represent the it's essentially a spy novel. But it also deals with an issue that we all called him A.J., dealt with repeatedly, which was identity. It's really a novel about somebody trying to prove he is who he is when
he's... Exactly. He loved to do that.
Yes. And he was brilliant at it.
One of my favorites also, which is not a shoot-'em-up space odyssey, is Michaelmas, where the man in charge of the whole world does it very quietly with the help of a computer, and he wrote that in the 1960s.
Where are you living now?
In Evanston.
I thought that you were local, yeah.
Yes, I am.
And your husband taught at Wisconsin, was it?
He did not teach... in a college.
He taught some at Columbia College, I believe. Didn't he?
Ah. Well, he did. He did one session at Harvard one summer. Mm-hmm. He taught at Michigan State in a writing program during the summers for about 10 years.
Yeah, I was going to mention that AJ was one of my teachers at Clarion in 1985.
Oh, I didn't really? Even remember
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I actually remember meeting you at his memorial service.
I made remember it up. Your being there.
Yeah,
I appreciate that no end.
What do you read in science fiction these days, apart from the great work of your own husband?
Would you believe I like mysteries?
Sure, I'd believe it.
Absolutely.
Of course.
I read very, very little science fiction.
Of course, Gary Wolf doubles. He does science fiction and he does mysteries.
Well, then, we're kindred spirits.
Yeah.
Some of us just like stories that have plots.
One of the great programs on this series, in the series years ago, was Gary Wolf was here, and, well, a number of them, but one of them was with P.D. James, the British mystery writer.
Aha. Mm-hmm.
Who has since written a science fiction novel, as a matter of fact, The Children of
Men. Children of Men is rather like, it was a dystopian thing.
It was a dystopian
yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, ma'am, thank you so much for calling us.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's been a real pleasure to hear from you. And with that, we'll go to the next caller, who turns out to be Joe, joining us at WGN Radio. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Milt. Thank you for having another great show. I have two quick questions, then I'll hang up because I'm about to enter a construction zone.
All right.
My first question is, what impact do you think science fiction shows on television, such as The Outer Limits and The Twilight Zone, which featured stories from Harlan Ellison and Richard Matheson and Robert Sheckley, had on the writing of science fiction past that? And the second question is, what impact will humanity have 50 years later concerning the writings of Carl Sagan and Arthur Clarke? Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting questions. Let's take a whack at that. William Shun.
Those television programs were definitely influential on people of my generation. I was watching those shows on TV before I understood that there was a written version of those same kinds of stories. So those formed the basis for what I was looking for when I went looking for novels and when I started trying to write my own stories when I was a 12, 13-year-old.
What was that Rod Serling series called?
That was The Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone, yeah.
One of the novels here in the series is called The Shrinking Man by Richard Matheson, who was very influential in The Twilight Zone. And there's an interesting historical footnote is that Matheson, when he sold that to the films, it was filmed under the title The Incredible Shrinking Man, had it written into his contract that he would get to write the screenplay, which was unheard of for a science fiction writer. But he did. The film became a hit. He had a career in Hollywood. He became one of a stable of writers with Rod Serling for The Twilight Zone, which I think started, 1959 or 1960. And that, in turn, led to The Outer Limits. And it was really the first time, I think, that real science fiction writers, our caller mentioned Harlan Ellison, for example, people who had careers writing fiction and novels, were getting an inroad into television. And I think that's when we began to see really interesting science fiction television and film.
On to the next caller, who turns out to be Alex. You're on the air, sir. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm from Soviet Union, so I really like to read the science fiction. It was like a bit of fresh air among the Soviet propaganda. And I wonder if some of your guests remember such author as Henry Kuttner, by any chance, in the 50s?
Yes, Henry Kuttner was he was married to a woman named Catherine L. Moore, and they wrote some wonderful collaborative
stories. Truly so. I couldn't find his books on the shelves, and even Gary Garrison, who died recently, unfortunately, this year, about a month ago, so also kind of was unbeknown. I went to Des Plaines on Niles Library. I couldn't find it 20 years ago on the bookshelves, you know.
But these were American science fiction writers that you read in the Soviet Union, is that it?
Yeah, in Russian also, so I made a good collection. I couldn't find it in English, so I made a good collection.
But there were also some very significant Russian science fictioneers.
Well, certainly, Strugatsky.
Yes, they were. They were awesome. Their first 10 books were really great. And Vadim Shefner, maybe he was writing in something about like kind of in a fiction way, also like that.
Tell me this. What was distinctive about the Soviet science fiction? How did it differ from the American stuff?
How to put it? I even don't know how to say. It was not so much of fiction in Soviet fiction. It was kind of life, but kind of dream about good life, kind of. That's what I would say. Rather than pure fiction was in American authors.
Maybe it was another form of samizdat, was it?
Not quite, but you read between the lines and you kind of trying to guess what they mean in reality.
In some Eastern European science fiction, certainly in the work of Stanislaw Lem.
Stanislaw Lem, exactly. I love it so much.
Very much a parody of bureaucracy.
Absolutely.
It's easy to see what he's really talking about.
Yeah. Yes, about the dragon who lived on the planet was long. And, well, to kill the dragon, it's interesting for our planet. You cannot do that.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, sir, for calling us.
Thank you.
Very interesting contribution. We're about to pause the last round of commercials, then right back to the phones. 312-591-7200. If you've been trying to get through and hitting the busy signal, there are now one or two lines available. If you move quickly, somebody will get in there.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Gary Wolf and to William Shun. And directly back to the phones. Here is a call from Bill. You're on the air, sir. Hello, are you there? Bill, going once, going twice, and I fear gone. And so the next caller will be Jay, and he, of course, is there. Good evening, sir.
Hello, Milt.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering if I wasn't a big science fiction reader, but a friend recommended some books to me called Callahan's Good Time Saloon. It was about different time travelers, and they all would stop in this saloon. I believe the author was a man named Savage, and it was a series of about four books. I never was interested in science fiction writing, but these were really interesting books.
Wasn't that Spider Robinson?
I think those were Spider Robinson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And they were, that's part of a tradition of science fiction, I guess, club stories where people gather around and tell tall tales in the way. They're very entertaining. There were some earlier ones done by Arthur Clarke called Tales from the White Heart. There was, an earlier one by Fletcher Pratt, I think. I can't remember what it was.
Here's an interesting, well, just a necessary email. Fellow seeks information, seeks a repetition. He says, I was just getting into my car earlier as you read an excerpt from a book that you compared to The Count of Monte Cristo, about a spaceman seeking revenge. Can you please let me know the title and the author of that book? It sounded very interesting.
That was The Stars My Destination by Alfred Bester.
Mm-hmm. The Stars My Destination by Alfred Bester, and it's one of the nine in this collection. And the title of this collection, the overall collection, American Science Fiction, Nine Classic Novels from the 1950s. Say again what you... A little bit more about the website that you mentioned.
Yeah, well, this is something that the Library of America wisely wants to devote as much space as it can to actual fiction. So there are no introductions. There are textual notes and that sort of thing. For the first time, they developed a website, or I helped them develop a website, which is really a companion to these nine novels, where we have interviews, excerpts from other works, short stories, in some cases whole radio and TV plays, and an essay on each of the nine novels by a contemporary writer. We have essays by Neil Gaiman and William Gibson and James Morrow and Connie Willis.
And I assume by you.
No. Well, I've written a lot of stuff on the website. Can I give the website? It's
please, yes.
www.loa.org/sciencefiction. It's easy to find, and that's free to anybody. You don't have to pay for it.
And you've got whole old television programs on there as well,
there,
you say?
Alfred Bester and some – there was a – famous story by C.M. Cornbluth, who's one of the authors represented here with Frederick Pohl with the Space Merchants, wrote a famous story called The Little Black Bag. And this was done on television in 1953, and we found the original Tales of Tomorrow from ABC, sponsored by some carpet company. And the entire episode is on the website.
Wonderful.
And there are radio programs. There's, as I mentioned, Lee Brackett, who's had one of the most fascinating careers as a pulp writer and then a Hollywood writer and began her Hollywood career writing The Big Sleep with William Faulkner, ended it with writing the screenplay for the original screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back. It's a long, almost hour and a half interview with her.
I'm eager to see this. Say once again the address of the website.
It's www.loa.org.
For Library of America.
Library of America. .org, O-R-G.
Yeah.
And then / science fiction, all one word.
Wonderful. I'm going to check that out tomorrow. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there's one of these fancy things on the box itself where you scan that with your phone or something.
Oh, yes.
QR code.
QR code. Thank you.
Yeah. Ain't science wonderful? And we go back to the phones, 312-591-7200, and say hello to Bill. Good evening. Bill, are you there?
Yes, Dr. Rosenberg.
Sir, go ahead.
Thank you. I've enjoyed your show for years. My question is this. I love both science fiction novels and films, but it appears to me that a series of films that were called The Terminators, starring Schwarzenegger, were basically a direct ripoff of plots from the Berserker sagas by Frederick Saberhage. And nowhere have I ever seen Saberhage accredited at all in any of those films.
I don't know that the idea of time travelers from the future altering the present was fairly common. The actual source, which James Cameron at one point admitted in an interview, was Harlan Ellison. It was specifically an episode. It was a short story that Harlan Ellison had written called Soldier, which was adapted into The Outer Limits, and watched by James Cameron. I'm pretty certain, if I'm not mistaken, that some interview he mentioned that he had seen that. Harlan Ellison's episode involves a highly technological soldier sent from the future to the present to assassinate somebody to prevent which is essentially the plot of the original Terminator film. I don't know that the Saberhagen – there's some of the same things going on in the Saberhagen stories. I suppose you're right.
Yeah, because there were, five or six novels, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's just something I always felt that was unjustified. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. And next up is Jan at 312-591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening. Great program as usual.
Thank you.
This is more in the 70s literature. Is Purnell ever going to finish the Janissary series? Jerry Purnell, he wrote Tran, not Tron the thing, but Tran and a couple of other ones, and then it just stopped.
I'm not aware if he's working on those novels.
Mm.
He was writing a column for Byte magazine for the longest time.
Oh, okay.
And that's the last writing I'd seen.
Well, what is that series? Obviously, I don't know it at all.
I'm not very familiar with that series either. It goes back to the early 70s, I believe.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, I hadn't read it either, but yeah. I did, when I was in high school, consume a lot of his collaborations with Larry Niven.
Yeah, so did I, but I just wanted to started reading that series, and then it just never ended, and then I'm just wondering if he had, if he was, first of all, if he was still alive, which I guess he is, but... Guess he hasn't done that yet. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man in Chicago who had great success writing books about a creature in the jungle, a Caucasian who wandered around and consorted with the apes. Mm-hmm. But also, he put other people up on Mars. It's Edgar Rice Burroughs. Does he count as a science fictioner?
Well, certainly the Princess of Mars series does... In terms of 1912 science fiction, this is the 100th anniversary of Princess of Mars. And interestingly enough, the Library of America has also reprinted that. It's not science fiction in any sense that we would recognize in the 21st century, I think. I mean, he's basically projected to Mars by something like magic. But it's an attempt at writing an interplanetary romance. It really is kind of fun. And really, the one of the big flop movies of this summer, John Carter, was a direct adaptation of it. And actually, I didn't think John Carter was that bad a movie.
Yeah, they were trying to recapture the sense of what the scientific possibilities seemed like 100 years ago rather than basing it on what we know now. Mm-hmm. And it may be one reason why it didn't connect with audiences.
A necessary question, even though it's a little bit on the... to academic side, does science fiction ascend to the level of true literary accomplishment rather than merely to stimulating intellectual narrative and exercise?
It can.
Is there anything that has lasting literary significance?
I think there's no doubt about that. I think the same thing is true of any genre of writing that's associated with a certain set of tropes is going to be looked at as formulaic.
So which are the great ones?
Of living writers, the two great American...
Living or dead?
Well, I'm going to mention the living ones because I think the two great living American science fiction writers are Ursula K. Le Guin and Gene Wolfe, who lives here in Barrington.
I know Le Guin. I don't know Gene Wolfe.
Gene Wolfe was, interestingly enough, received the first Henry Blake Fuller Award from the Chicago Literary Hall of Fame just last March. He's written very subtle, very sophisticated, extensive novels and short stories. He's absolutely brilliant. But one of the things that I think has limited his audience is that his most famous work is essentially a set of four trilogies or three quartets. It's essentially 12 novels describing a single arc, which are extremely subtle and extremely admired by all sorts of literary as well as science fiction.
A little bit more about that. What does he do within?
His most famous book is The Book of the New Sun. And, Bill, you could probably describe that as well as I could.
I've probably read The Book of the New Sun four or five times. I first ran into it in high school as it was first being published. It's a far future saga of a torturer named Severian who lives on Earth so far in the future that the sun is swollen and red. You can see stars at night. The moon is green because it's been terraformed at some point. And Severian embarks on essentially a hero's quest throughout this strange future world. But Wolf pulls in all sorts of science fictional concepts as well as an incredible amount of self-referential literary allusions.
Hmm.
It's a dense work. It demands to be read multiple times.
I like your reference to Ursula Le Guin. I have read some of her.
Mm-hmm.
She is, as you will remember, the daughter of a famous anthropologist, Alfred Kroeber, I believe.
Alfred Kroeber and her mother, Theodora Kroeber, had written a famous book called Ishi, the Last of His Tribe. So she grew up in a house.
Yeah.
She grew up with a sophisticated understanding of anthropology.
We're just about out of time. I need to take a moment to talk about things to come. This Sunday, my guest will be a man I much enjoy and who is, I think, one of the truly illuminating figures in American journalistic intellectual life, namely Mark Stein, a master of apocalyptic stand-up, one might say. And then next week, we've got some interesting things coming. Two shorter programs, Monday and Tuesday, and Wednesday night, of course, is the great debate. The first of the three presidential debates. The station, we will carry it beginning, I believe, at 8 o'clock and running till 9:30. And then Extension 720 will come on early, that is at 9:30, and stay with it for the next 2.5 hours until midnight with some very significant discussants doing very significant discussion. Among them, some of our regular A-team, plus a political scientist who's coming in from the West Coast, who's got some very interesting things to say and is truly, I promise, a serious Democrat. That's what is to come. Now it is virtually time to go. We do urge you to check out our website at wgnradio.com/extension720 for access to all the podcasts for the recent programs. Indeed, this one will be up by tomorrow afternoon, but also for all the classic Extension 720 programs to be found on that very website. My thanks to Gary Wolfe and William Shun for a most interesting evening. Thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night to all.